rocking. All right, happy Friday. Y'all remember, I'm sure, Shay started the residency semester talking about the progress of each month, of how you hit September, you're just pumped to be here. October, you're like, yeah, I'm glad I'm a part of it. And you kind of just walk through each month. How many of you are starting to feel a little bit, especially on a Friday, it's getting a little bit colder, although actually it's still kind of warm. Starting to feel that a little bit. Yeah, I'm with you. But I really want to encourage you. It is absolutely worth hanging in there. And this is a class that just pays off in so many ways. I've had the opportunity, even as a pastor, to take so much of what I've learned from residency and the teachers and really a lot of the people in our church, just conversations and so forth. So encourage you, hang in there. It's absolutely worth it. So game plan for this morning. We wrapped up Genesis. I actually want to return just real quickly to the very end of Genesis. Kind of ran out of time yesterday, but I wanted to just quickly tie it together and once again take a look at the big God that we saw in the book of Genesis and show how that moves us into the book of Exodus. How many of you saw the movie Gods and Kings last year? All right. So if I do a good job, this will be nothing like that. That's the game plan. I mean, Christian Bale's awesome. I'm a big fan. But it's hard not to be a little disappointed when they change as many things as they do. But it is Hollywood, so what do you expect? So it's neat to see some things that kind of bring it to life. But also you have to watch a little bit with a filter. And so our goal as we walk through will be to see really God in action in Exodus. And so I just want to, and then we'll take a quick look at the overview of Exodus as we look at deliverance, and then I've got a quick video for you guys. I don't have some cool practical proverbs. I figured I'd save those for Mike, so instead I'm going to just show you a fancy video that someone else came up with. So what I want to do, go back to Genesis 50 real quick. And you guys remember, as we wrap that up, what did you notice about the attitude of the brothers after their dad, Jacob, passes away? So now it's just the brothers and Joseph. What did they do right after Jacob dies?
They were scared.
They were afraid that Joseph was basically just covering up and pretending to forgive, but now that dad is gone, he's going to wipe him out and take basically his revenge or his vengeance out on him. But Joseph is just grieved that this is their understanding of who he is. And if you remember, Mike has just done a great job walking through the story of Joseph, of showing us how Joseph is really a great picture of what God is like in our lives. And so when we consider Joseph the way that we would in many ways as we look up to God, we see the character of God through Joseph, and we see that he's one who forgives. We see that he's one who loves to provide. And so I want to just spend some time as we look at a big overview of Genesis and then move into Exodus. I was thinking about a quote, and I know from the very beginning Mike has said we want a big view of God when we walk through Genesis. And I was thinking about a man by the name of A.W. Tozer says, "What comes into one's mind when thinking about God is the most important thing about him." And basically what he means is when we think about God, the picture that comes to our mind shapes our identity. It shapes who we are and what we do. So if we have this small picture of God, we're going to, in a sense, try and walk all over God because we just don't think there's any consequences in life. And so that begins to shape our identity. It shapes who we are, what we do, because we just think, well, there's not that many consequences. God's not going to intervene because we have a small view of God. If we have kind of like this jolly Santa Claus type picture of God, we're going to treat him, as has been said before in this class, kind of like a vending machine God. If I do the right things, if I had a good year, I'm going to get a good present. In that sense, God's going to take care of me. I do the right things. I pull the right levers. God's going to be good to me. He's like a jolly Santa Claus. Another thought is if we have this really angry view of God, we just see him as someone that we just fear, and he's not loving. He's kind of like the old Greek gods where if you mess up, a bolt of lightning is going to come out of nowhere and wipe you out. And so what we see here is that the brothers of Joseph have that type of view of God. They have that type of view of Joseph. that he's not someone who forgives. He's not someone who is both just and wrathful, as well as merciful and loving. And what Joseph shows us in 20 and 21, as he says, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted him and spoke kindly to them. So I hope as you looked and as you walked through the book of Genesis, you saw a really big, accurate view of God. And as we continue to walk through it, I hope your view and your perspective of God continues to grow and grow, not as just this jolly, happy-go-lucky God, but not also as this angry God that's going to wipe you out when you make one mistake. We see this really unique, beautiful balance in God. He's a just God who pours his wrath out on sin because he knows sin damages us. It kills us. So he has his wrath towards it, but he's also, as Joseph shows us, he comforts us. He speaks kindly to us. He's a God who loves to provide. And what I love, as we see, as we talked about, all the way back from Genesis 3:15, when Adam and Eve screwed up and they rebelled against God, right away God provides for them. He comes, he comforts them, he provides atonement or covering for them. And what we see then is he says there's going to be one who comes, speaking all the way forward to the New Testament, to Jesus. There's going to be one who comes who will crush the head of the serpent. So he's saying he's going to come and he is going to wipe out sin and death. And that's how much God loves us and cares for us. He would provide his own son for us to wipe that out and to comfort us and to provide for us. He provides his own son. So I hope that as we walk into Exodus, from Genesis, we see this big, sovereign God, and now into Exodus, who's on a mission to provide redemption for the people he loves. So we're going to walk into Exodus and take a look at that. So with that, I don't know, do you guys have the Exodus chart yet? Has that been put in Dropbox? Or okay, you don't have it yet, so I'm sure Mike will do that when he gets back, and you guys will be set with that. So for now, we'll just do a quick overview of it. Mike might dive a little deeper into it when he gets back next week. But for now, I'll give you just kind of a big picture outline. We're going to move into it. So, Exodus, the theme is going to be redemption or deliverance. I believe Mike wants you to focus on the idea of deliverance, especially for your exam. I think just focus in on that idea of deliverance. But you're going to see that kind of interchangeably as we walk through Exodus. You're going to see redemption and deliverance. What you're going to see in the first 11 chapters is Israel's subjection. Can you all read that back there? I didn't win any handwriting awards in school, so hopefully you can see it. Or spelling awards, if any of you were here earlier. Took me about 3 minutes and about 5 different opinions to spell dilemma, right? So anyway, so Israel's subjection, you're going to see in 1 through 11. We're going to see them enslaved in the land of Egypt, where we ended up and left off in Genesis. We see them. Now we're going to pick up in 1 and see how they transition from settling in the land of Egypt to actually becoming enslaved by the king. The second part of the book you're going to see is Israel's discipleship. You're going to see this 12 through 18 as God prepares them to exit the land of Egypt and freed from enslavement. And they're going to go through some things where God begins to teach them and work in them and begin to show his people that they can trust him as the God of their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then finally, on the back half of the book, you're going to see Israel's revelation. This is where, as they exit Egypt and they start wandering around, they come to the base of Mount Sinai, where God will give them the law. And God will begin to walk through them and begin to show them, because it's been over 400 years since they've really felt and seen God's presence in their lives. God begins to reveal to them who he is and what he's like as their God. So that's a kind of a flying overview. We'll go a little bit deeper into that as we work through the first few chapters. I want to show you this video that actually one of my professors up in Western Seminary teamed up with a guy. And the professor, he's also a pastor of a church in Portland. He's kind of a little bit of your hipster, stereotypical Portland type young pastor guy. And he teamed up with a guy at Google, a really creative guy. Christian guy that also worked for Google, and they had this heart and this mission to be a nonprofit that creates these 5-minute videos of the overview of each book of the Bible. And so you'll see they're kind of quirky. They like to have a little bit of fun. But this just gives you a big snapshot of what we're looking at the book of Exodus. So this is just part one. Some of the bigger books they put into two chunks. So this is just going to look through 1 through 19. They divide Exodus a little bit differently, which is okay. You're going to want to know this for residency and the way that Mike has split it up. It's funny, yesterday I looked at about 3 or 4 different outlines, and every single one was different. Everybody has kind of split Exodus up a little bit differently, but this is the one you're going to want to know. But let's check this video out for a bit.
Let's talk about the book of Exodus. Now, you're probably familiar with this book because of the epic story of Moses leading Israel out of slavery from Egypt.
Yeah, but that's just the first half of the book. The second half has Moses giving the Ten Commandments to Israel, along with these blueprints for making his sacred tent. Now, right here in the middle is this story that connects these two halves together, and it all takes place at the foot of a famous mountain.
Okay, so let's start back at the beginning.
So the first thing we have to remember is we're continuing the story from Genesis.
Yeah, in Genesis, God promised Abraham that through his family, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And Genesis ends with Abraham's family down in Egypt. When Exodus begins, 400 years have passed, the family grows, and becomes the people group now called Israel.
But there's this huge problem, because the Israelites are enslaved to this king of the Egyptians, a guy called Pharaoh.
This guy is really bad news.
Yeah, he's horrible. He disregards their humanity, he brutally enslaves them, and he even orders that all of the Israelites' sons should be killed by throwing them into the Nile River. He wants to wipe these people out. The worst character in the Bible so far.
Here's where we meet an Israelite woman who wants to save her son.
And so she does throw him in the river, but safely, in this little reed basket.
And Pharaoh's daughter finds this baby and takes him as her own.
This is the boy who grows up to become Moses, the man who will rescue Israel from slavery.
So Moses grows up, and one day, much later in his life, he has this crazy encounter with God where he comes across a bush that's on fire, but it isn't actually burning up.
God speaks from the bush, and he appoints Moses as the man he will use to deliver Israel.
So Moses goes to Pharaoh to tell him this news that God wants his people free.
And Pharaoh, he just pretty much laughs at him. He's like, who's this God Yahweh? And in fact, he's so offended by this request, he decides to make the Israelites work even harder.
So discouraged, Moses goes back to God and says, listen, this plan's not going to work.
But God repeats his promise that he's going to rescue them. And in fact, it's right here, for the first time in the Bible, that we hear the word redemption. It literally just means to purchase a slave's freedom. But God here uses this word to describe what he's going to do for enslaved Israel.
And God knows Pharaoh is going to resist, so he sends 10 different plagues, one after another, like turning water into blood, sending all sorts of pests and disease. These plagues are really severe.
They are severe, but we need to understand that the story is presenting these as acts of divine justice against one of the worst oppressors in the story of the Bible. And they're all aimed at the purpose of rescuing these enslaved people and defeating the gods of Egypt.
This all comes to a climax at the 10th plague, where God's going to kill the firstborn sons across all Egypt. Every house, it's pretty rough.
It is, but it's also God's response for how Pharaoh killed the Israelite sons.
Now as you turn the page, you suddenly get 2 long chapters of detailed instructions for what's essentially throwing a dinner party with a recipe for a lamb.
Yeah, but this lamb is super important. God tells the Israelites to pick it out and to prepare it to be eaten. And they're supposed to take its blood and then paint it all over the doorframe of their house. And anyone who is in that house will be spared from this final plague. And so this meal, which is called Passover, it commemorates this key moment in the story where God brings his justice on human evil, but also shows mercy by providing this substitute.
This final plague makes Pharaoh angry, and he demands that Israel gets out of Egypt, which is great. But suddenly, as they leave, Pharaoh changes his mind. He has a change of heart.
But on top of that, we're also told that God hardens Pharaoh's heart.
Why would God do that?
Well, what we need to remember is that over and over in this story, Pharaoh has already chosen to harden his own heart. And so at this point, Pharaoh, he's not just evil, he's become monstrous and evil. Even his own advisors think that he has gone way too far. And so how is God supposed to deal with such an extreme form of evil? And what we see in this story is that God uses his power to lure evil into its own destruction.
Pharaoh and his army are destroyed in the Red Sea as Israel passes into freedom.
And after this, we find the very first song of worship in the Bible, as people praise God for redeeming them. And it's in this story that the word salvation is also used for the first time, which means simply to be rescued from danger.
Now that they're saved, you would think that everything should be great. But the story quickly turns. The Israelites start wandering in the desert. They're tired, hungry, lost. And you start to wonder, what's God doing? What were they saved for?
And we learn the answer to that question in the very next story, which ties the two parts of this whole book together.
Hi, this is Tim.
And this is John.
We think one of the best ways to understand the...
All right, so if you're like me and pictures really help and a pop-up Bible you think is like the best way of starting to grasp the story, that's kind of how I am. Go ahead and check that out. It's on YouTube. They're free videos. It's called The Bible Project, and it's just those two guys working through the Bible. So if you want to go back, check out Genesis. It's really helpful. I find it before I start studying a new book on my own or whatever, I'll just watch a quick overview, kind of, in a sense, gives you a good outline, and then you start working through it and filling in the lines. So with that, let's jump in. One thing I forgot to mention, just the overview that we're going to notice as we walk through Exodus, is you're going to see three parts of Moses' life. So as we get to Moses in chapter 2, it's really divided up quite nicely to where you're going to see Moses is going to live 120 years total. And it's really split into three sections of 40 years of his life. And so you're going to see the first 40 years of his life is going to be in the land of Egypt. And then he's going to go spend the next, the middle 40 of his years out in the desert as a shepherd. And then he's going to come back into Egypt and then eventually back out into the wilderness for the last 40 years of his life. And so we're going to see these different developments of Moses' life and his leadership as we move through there. So, all right, I hope you guys are awake. Gave you a little extra time this morning for the caffeine to knock in. Let's go for it. There's going to be a good little bit of controversy this morning, so I hope you're ready for that. We're going to get to it right away. So with that now, as we jump into Exodus 1, Moses now gives us a quick recap of where we left off in Genesis and who came from the land, the promised land, into Egypt. And then where we are now as we jump into the book. So somebody take the first six verses of chapter 1.
Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came, each one with his household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation.
All right. So remember how many people came from the promised land as we wrapped up Genesis, and Jacob brought his family back to Egypt and settled in the land of Goshen. How many were there? It says right there, 70. Does anybody remember? We talked about it now here in this story when they're going to exit Exodus, how many are we going
to
see?
1.5 to 3 million.
Yeah, almost 1.5 to 3 million, somewhere in there. So they start at 70. They're going to end up growing and multiplying. You see that in 6 and 7. They're fruitful. They increase greatly. And now they're starting to outnumber the people of Egypt. And as you can see, Pharaoh is starting to get a little bit nervous. He's getting nervous as the Israelites are becoming a little bit bigger. And so now in 8 through 11, we see how Pharaoh reacts in light of that. Somebody take 8 through 11.
Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses."
All right, so now we see a new king over Egypt, which is significant because it's several generations now, right? It's been over 400 years, and this king, this Pharaoh, does not know Joseph. He does not remember or appreciate what Joseph did. We saw this is a huge switch This is a huge change to where Joseph went from being like the right-hand man, almost like a best friend of Pharaoh, and was trusted and respected by the king of Egypt. And now over these decades, that relationship has completely changed. And now the Pharaoh has no appreciation for what Joseph did or who the Israelites are. And so what's he doing in response? What's his strategy as the Israelites are growing?
Break them, basically.
Yeah, break them. He's going to, not only is he going to get free work out of them and enslave them and kind of keep them controlled, but it seems like his goal is he's going to wear them down. Because it says here, like, what if the enemies come against us and the Israelites jump on their side? They're going to wipe us out. And so he's like, if we can control them, if we can get free work out of them, we're also going to wear them down through hard, back-breaking work. Let's take a look at 12 through 14. Somebody pick up there. Alright, so in verse 12, as you look at this idea, the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. Does that remind you of anything else? Does that trigger something for you?
Spread of the church.
Spread of the church, yeah. You guys have been, where are you guys with Shay?
2 days in.
2 days into?
Acts.
Oh, into Acts?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought you were already through Acts, so I might have jumped the gun there a little bit, but you're going to get to it. How's that? So now when you're in Acts, you'll see the similarities back to Genesis, to where you see oppression, but they multiply in the midst of that persecution in that. And so Shay will jump more a little bit deeper into that and the implications of that as you work through Acts. So we see that Pharaoh now, his strategy is not only to enslave the Israelites, but he's also going to do one more thing just to ensure that the Israelites don't become too much in numbers. So somebody pick up 15 through 17. Let's see his next step.
Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrews' midwives, of whom the name of one was Shaphira, and the name of the other was Pua. And he said, when you do the duties of the midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, you shall keep them alive. Through 17?
Yeah, through 17.
But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive.
Perfect, thanks. Just as a way of a side note, this is very interesting as you look at this story. And if you fast forward, as we've been talking about how we see the thread that points all the way forward to Jesus, if you look at the birth of Jesus, and you look at that, there's a lot of really fascinating similarities in the story between Moses and Jesus. And as you look at what Pharaoh does here about killing all the boys. And now here's where we're going to get to some good conflict, some good ethical dilemma. We've got it spelled right. You can be sure of that, thanks to a few smarter people in the room. So we're gonna work through this. And we're going to look at this idea of, so Pharaoh asks the midwives, or he doesn't ask them, he commands them, when you come upon the Hebrew women when they're about to give birth, if it's a girl, that's okay. If it's a boy, he's got to be killed. He's got to be taken care of so that the Israelites don't continue to grow. So now these Hebrew midwives are in a dilemma, right? Obviously, they don't want to take these boys' lives. They know before God that is murder. They do not want to do that. But they're commanded by the government. They're commanded by Pharaoh. So let's see what they do. Let's actually go back to 17. Somebody take 17 through 22, and we'll take a look at that.
But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt with dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live."
All right, perfect. So what is the midwives' response to Pharaoh's command?
A lie.
A lie, yeah. They save the boys' lives, and they lie. And interestingly, what do you see God's response to them? And we're going to dive into this a little. We're going to stop and sit here for a while and dive a little deeper into this. What do you see God's response to the lie of the midwives?
God was good to the midwives.
He dealt well with them. And he gave them families. Interesting. So as we look at a few different stories similar to this in the Bible, there's about three prominent ones that pop up where people are caught in this ethical dilemma. They're caught in between, do I follow this law or do I follow this law? And this one obviously is a big one in Scripture. Another one you're going to see as you guys continue to move through, you're going to get to the story of Joshua. And if you're familiar with the story of Rahab, and she is caught in this spot where she is actually hiding a few of the Israelite spies in her own house. And then the government comes to her and she lies to them. But then it seems like once again, God does, he blesses her for it. He deals well with her. Another interesting one you'll see all the way in the book of Acts, you'll get to this with Shay probably in a few days, is Peter and John are going to stand before the ruling authorities, the religious leaders, and they're told to stop proclaiming the gospel. And they say, no, this is what our lives are about. You can't stop us. We're going to submit ourselves to you, but we're going to keep preaching the gospel. So you're going to see these different stories where people are caught in the middle. And so I want to just take a minute for us to think through, what could that mean for our lives when we find ourselves in a situation where it seems like we're going to have to break one law in order to keep the other, or we're going to have to go against government in order to obey God? Or do we submit ourselves to government and remain quiet? What's that look like? And so I wrote up there three fancy words. These are not my words, as you probably know. I was happy I spelled them right. These are more Rick Taylor words. So there's three different kind of perspectives or views that very good, solid Christians would take coming to a situation like this. The first is called non-conflicting absolutism. So this is the idea. If you're in this camp, you would say that God would never put you in a situation where you had to choose one or the other. That God would never put you in a spot where you had to break a rule or break a law or sin in order to do what's right. And so what they would argue is that just tell the truth. And God in his sovereignty, they're real strong on the sovereignty side. God will take care of it. Just do what you know is right. God will take care of it. The second one that you're going to see is conflicting absolutism. So this is the idea that, yes, we are going to be in situations where we got to choose one or the other. In that circumstance, you're going to have to choose the lesser of two evils. But in choosing that, you have to recognize you're going to be responsible for the consequence of the sin that you did. So you're going to be responsible for the lesser of two evils. So in this example, they would say the Hebrew midwives did what was right. They saved the lives of these boys, but they're going to be responsible for the sin of lying, that they're ultimately going to receive the consequence for that. The third camp is going to be graded absolutism. And this is the idea of you choose the greater good. So in one sense, Rick gives a really good example of hierarchy, or how one law supersedes the other. So the example is the idea of the law of gravity. So you see, the law of gravity would say there is no way that a, I don't know, how much would you say a 747 would weigh? Any idea? Just a big old hunk of metal. How it weighs a ton, okay? So the law of gravity would say a 747 should never be able to be in the air. Should never be able to make it in the air. It should always stay on the ground. But when the law of aerodynamics comes in, it supersedes. It comes above the law of gravity. And now a big old hunk of metal is able to be in the air, basically overcoming the law of gravity. So you and I, though we are subjected to the law of gravity, through the law of aerodynamics, we are able to be in the air and supersede. And so this idea, what they would say is that we're going to be in these situations and we have to choose the greater good. So in this example, murder is far worse than lying. And so we choose the greater good. We say that saving the life and keeping away from murder is the greater choice. And so what I want to do is, this might open a can of conflict here, but let's do it. I like this idea. Somebody gave me a good thought yesterday. So to make you wake up a little bit, I just want to hear your guys' thoughts on this. I'm actually going to make you get up and get to walk around a little bit on a Friday, which is always a good thing. So I want you to think through this. If you're number one, so if you're in camp one and you would say, let me give you an example first. Let's use this story. Let's say that you were a part during the World Wars, and the Nazis at this time are exterminating the Jews. And you are a German. You live in Germany, but you have a heart for the Jews. And you feel like God has given you the heart and the calling to preserve the life of as many Jews as you can. And so you actually have Jews that are knocking on your door and asking if you would hide them. And so you bring a few Jews into your home and you hide them in your basement. But now Nazi soldiers come knocking on your door and they ask you, do you have any Jews in your home? And now you're in this ethical dilemma. The government is telling me that I need to obey. I need to tell the truth because I do have Jews in my home. But I do know that if I tell the truth, there is probably a 95 to 100% chance that these Jews are going to be killed and murdered in the hand of the Nazi rule. And so with that picture in mind, as we look at these three camps, as we look at these three stories throughout Scripture, I'd love to know, what do you do in that moment? So if you're that German and you open your door and the Nazi soldier's looking at you, do you take the camp one and you say, I'm going to just tell the truth? And I'm going to trust that God is going to provide. God is either going to save their lives and mine, or he's not. But in his sovereignty, he had a reason for choosing not to save us. So if you're in camp one, I want you to get up and move over to this side of the room. The second one, if you've got that, not yet. I'll have you all move in a minute. I saw a few people ready to jump. The big sovereignty. The second camp would be this idea of you're going to choose the lesser of two evils, but you recognize that you're going to receive the consequence for your sin of lying. So in this circumstance, you would lie to the Nazis, but you would say, you know what, I know that I'm going to stand before God and I'm going to receive that responsibility, or I'm going to take the responsibility of knowing that I lied. That would be camp two. Camp three would say, no, I'm going to lie, and I'm going to save their lives at all costs, and I believe God's going to bless me for it. I believe God's going to bless me for that decision of lying. All right, so everybody clear? Any questions on those different camps? Yeah.
Is it what we think is the correct answer, or what we, like, because I think what is right and what I would actually do are two different things.
Oh.
So which one are you
going
to do?
You're
going to
be just hopping around, I think.
I know,
yeah.
So I just don't know which one to go to.
All right, so you, what is right or what you would do? So you would do something different than what you think is right? Oh, man. We are going to have some internal conflict, maybe some external conflict. This could be interesting. Let's do this. What if the Nazi is knocking on your door, what would you do?
Okay.
Let's do that. What would you do in that moment? All right. Any other questions on what camp is where, or further explanation?
I think you should keep it theoretical.
Oh, okay.
Because that's what it is. You know what I mean? It's like, you're trying to say, like, one of these is right.
Yeah.
Now, if we get scared in the moment and don't do what is right, well, that means we went against what we think is right.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah, I would prefer to hear that. Okay. What do you think is right? Yeah, I see where you're going. That brings better clarity. Good call, Eric. I like that. I see where you're going with that. Okay, so what do you think out of these three camps is right? Is there any confusion I can clear up before you get up and there's chaos? Everybody understand? Yeah. All right. So if you believe that you should tell the truth and leave it up to God, get to this side of the room. If you believe that you would lie, but you're going to take the responsibility of that lie, go to the back near the coffee. And if you're like, I'm going to lie, but God's going to bless me for it, go to this side of the room. All right, get up and go.
My persisters
are so great. Yeah, harmonizers are just dying right now. I know. I have a lot of harmonizer, too. Some people are just staying seated. Oh, wow. This is looking pretty even. Yeah. Okay, I think the graded absolutism is outweighing a little bit. But it's actually a little more even than I expected. Okay, now I would love to hear, it's okay for a little bit of conflict, a little bit of good, healthy debate. I would love to hear from a few of you in each camp why you would believe that your position is right, your camp is right, and why you would take that stance in that moment. So let's start on this side. Yeah.
Your story helped us, or at least me, because Corey Ten Boom.
Yeah.
So you're telling the exact same story that actually put me in that place.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm in this stance. Which is Corey Ten Boom. Do you want me to share
that story? Yeah, share that story, Corey Ten Boom.
So Corey Ten Boom, her and her sister were harboring Jews. This is a real story. And she's like, no, do not lie at any cost. I can't. If they knock and ask if I have Jews, I'm going to tell them. The sister's like, no, you can't do that. You're going to sacrifice these lives. So there's this conflict. So sure enough, as the Germans always do, they come by and knock on the door and say, hey, are you harboring Jews? She says, yes, they're in the kitchen underneath the table, and we're harboring them there. The guy slaps her and says, how dare you insult me? And moves on. So in that situation, God was still sovereign, protected them, and she didn't have to sin. So that's how that story ended.
Yeah.
And that kind of radically, and it's called a sinful expedient, the others. And
I should have had this guy do the spelling,
sorry,
by the way. That's
no,
that's
I'm just
like,
so
yeah.
I can't spell.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But yeah, and so I wrestled with this well, but that literal story is the one that changed mine.
Good, good. How about one of the other camps?
Yeah, if they die 95% of the time, what does your point validate?
Why would you harbor something that you're not even going to say?
That's
going to make sense from the beginning. Like,
maybe you should just say your view instead of attacking the other view.
Let's do it.
Well, I think what you're saying is like when you're playing, essentially the odds, you don't know what's going to happen. But if you're trying to help someone, then you're going to do everything you can to help them. You can't control that either. No one can control any of our decisions, whether you say yes or no, or yeah, they're here or they're not here. The Nazis could still come in.
I see somebody moving sides. we have a deserter in the room. Yeah.
But one wonders, is it God's intent for us to break his commandments ever?
Well,
how did Genesis end? With what we intend for bad, God intends for good. The thing is God at the end controls any outcome. He has absolute sovereignty.
That's why this side is right.
So
the middle saying God's gonna work it out. I trust his sovereignty, but I'm also gonna take the responsibility of my sin. I think is what you're saying. Like you're happy that you're right there.
My thing is not necessarily that free will. I'm gonna be punished, but I think that punishment still happens because it's in a fallen and depraved world. Like that's the context of what's happening. So that punishment would be like. Well, ultimately, like, Stephen does die, you know, for, like, going against the government, going against the power.
Absolutely.
So technically that's a punishment, but not against him necessarily.
Yeah.
And then also, like, the punishment would also fall on the Jews who, like, killed him, you know, the powers that did kill him. So I believe, like, he was faithful to it, but ultimately a punishment needed to be had for what he chose to do, you know, in going against that.
Yeah.
Like,
that's good. Yeah.
So wouldn't you be lying to the Jews, telling them that you're harboring them, and then you don't? So aren't you lying to one party, one way or the other?
Yeah, that is a good question.
Not if you necessarily, like, hey, yeah, you can come in, but if they knock on the door, I'm letting them know you're here.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Then you help nobody.
Yeah. Why would you go, okay, yeah, I'm going to go into your home. Like, I don't see why you
do that. From my perspective, I'm a probation officer, and my whole family's law enforcement officer, and it kind of comes down to, if you look at just sin as it is, 95% of the men in my family are killers because they've been put in situations mm-hmm. in a simple world where it's them or other innocent people. And with me, I've already come to terms that when my day comes, I'm going to save someone. Mm-hmm. I'll take that shot. I'll do what I need to do. And I don't think that I'm going to enwrap sin for that because it's a sinful world and God gave me certain gifts to put me in a position to protect people. So I don't think that'll come upon me. And you just kind of look at all the warriors in the Bible and all the battles that go on. Killing is a sin. It's part of the Ten Commandments. But sometimes God calls for it. And sometimes God says it needs to be done. And he blesses the protector. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't think that certain sin would fall on people mm-hmm. with a making good choices.
So unlike Camp 2, you would say God's going to bless you and you're not going to necessarily take the responsibility or be held accountable for the choice that you made.
Correct.
Yeah. It's good to see you guys.
My question for you is all killing sin, though? Because, like you said, sometimes God asks it. So is all killing? Now, murder is sin.
Absolutely.
So not killing. So that's the difference, is actually committing the sin to try to help God. Now, killing is not always a sin. Now, if you murder with a hateful heart, that would be a sin. So for you to just do your duty and job, sin? I personally don't think so. Now, if you lie to try to help out your team, somebody says, hey, takes you hostage, where are they? And at that point in time, you have to decide, do I sin or do I be honest? I think that's more the moral conflict.
What's the definition of murder?
So I think it comes down to the heart, whether or not it's a duty or like a calling, something that you feel responsible to. Or if it's a selfish heart condition where you want vengeance or revenge. So, for instance, the two brothers, they went through with a hateful heart, whereas sometimes David was more of a servant, fulfilling God's duty.
Do you
so.
Think with lying it could come down to a heart issue as well, as with murder? I mean, where's,
I think lying, though, is always out of fear and a lack of faith in God. It's just like anything. Anytime that we step out, and do things on our own. Look at the Bible. How many times people said, well, let me do it this way. Abraham with his wife, sinful expedient. He's like, well, I'm going to lie and say that she's my sister because I want to protect her.
Max is all about that.
But there is consequences. Yeah. So the Bible does it. But the thing is God beyond that? We rationalize in our logic how, but you have to ask yourself, can God operate outside of what we think logically can happen? Has he done that in the Bible?
I think that we have to take it back to Jesus and when, during the Passover, when he healed a man, or I'm sorry, Sabbath, he healed a man, mm-hmm. and he rebuked him for it, and he said that what is more, sorry, I can't remember exactly what
he said. That's good. I think, is it when he says, Sabbath was made for man, not man for Sabbath, along those lines?
Right, and so kind of like it's more important to save a soul than in their sense of keeping it holy.
So wouldn't that be the greater good instead of the lesser of two evils?
He's trying to woo you over to that side.
Wait,
yeah.
Can I ask?
Two or three more thoughts, and then we're going to get back into the Word, but I would love to hear your guys' thoughts. So let's go with you, Eric, and then one more thought in the back.
I don't have a question. Is there an absolute answer? Like, are you going to explain to us right now?
I'll get to that in a minute. Yeah.
So are we just arguing for no reason because you could take many sins?
No, I don't think we're arguing for no reason because I think this is very practical and these are decisions you're going to have to make at points. I think there are times where you're going to reach this. Now, I want to be careful and I want to be clear. Now, this isn't on black and white issues of, well, I know the Bible says this, but I feel like that's where we get dangerous. So I want to make sure we don't leave this conversation without understanding. This never should never be an excuse for us to do something against God's word just because, well, I feel like. It should never be based off of that.
But
so,
the Bible's clear on which one of these standpoints is correct?
I don't think so. Okay. So to answer your question, I would say this is a gray area to where God, we talk a lot about here at the Well, the anatomy of a disciple, morally discerning, ethical dilemma, moral dilemma. I think in this moment is where we need to lean into the Lord and ask for that discernment, that wisdom in the moment. I do believe, because I believe there are really strong and well-balanced Christians that would land in any or three camps. I mean, you see, this is a room of students that are here to read the Bible, to grow in their understanding, and we have almost three even groups. And so I think it would be wrong for me to say, no, this is it. I think each of you has some valid points. So a few more thoughts, and then let's get back into the Word.
I think I would be on that end.
Yeah.
If it weren't for, if we're saying that God's sovereignty will take care of everything, then we shouldn't break the law in allowing the Jews to come into the house in the first place.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. That.
Well, I would
in that
agree
case,
with that, but Jesus said to submit to authority unless it causes you to dishonor God, and so that's why I was struggling with these two camps, because what I would do, I know in my human nature, that's what I would do, is that I would lie and I would choose to sin and I would accept the punishment of that because my heart would be to try to save these people. But my purpose in life is to glorify God and try to be the perfect sinless Jesus as much as I can. That's the point in why God created me, not to try to save people and justify my sin. And I know that's what I would do, but I don't think that's why God created me, if that makes sense.
Right, but what my understanding in that case would be that I could be within God's sovereign plan. So the fact of that person or family coming to ask for help in itself is already causing me to break a law, i.e. sin, to...
I think the difficulty, you're right.
I said we're going to stop, so can I...
Yeah, all right.
I should make the point before.
All right, last thought, and we're going to sit down.
Yeah, we
have
three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eric counts as two.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, Eric. Mike, I'm tying a bunch of knots that you're going to get to untangle. I'm sorry. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I would also say on your point about Jesus that... what he was saying is the extra laws that you put on the Pharisees on what Sabbath is are inaccurate. You know what I mean? On like what Sabbath is. So I wouldn't say that Jesus was like, no, I'm going to choose a sin, but it's a lesser sin, so it's not a sin.
Right. I'm not saying that
right.
Jesus was sinning.
Yeah. And then I would say
that would be kind of a deal breaker. Now, that would be a knot that Mike would never
Hillary,
ever teach
like,
again.
That's why I was kind of like, no, I want to clarify. Let's just say what is right and not what I would do because... I'm not perfect and don't think we're staying up here like, yeah, we're just going to do like this. But I would say that God is sovereign. And like, even in this conversation, what we're trying to do is say like, I would choose to lie because that's God's sovereign plan. You know what I mean? Like I would choose to sin because it's God's sovereign plan. We all fall under that. But when we choose to like act in a way that like in the Bible, it says it's sin, that means we think we know better than God, and that's in any context. So, like, even in this, I don't know if God's blessing them because of that or if it's because they did what is right and not killing the babies. I think that's why they were blessed, not because then they responded by saying they lied.
Yeah, that's a good question because, like, Max, you talk a lot about Abraham was blessed when he lied, and sometimes we have to ask the question, is it because we did what was right, or is it because God is just overly gracious and gives us gifts we don't deserve, even when we do mess up? So that's another thing for us to wrestle through. So all right, last one. I know you like really want to, and then we're gonna sit down. So I'm gonna weaken a little bit. Go ahead.
I think kind of all those stories point to the fact that ultimately punishment happens. So I'll start with the midwives, right?
Yeah.
So they chose what would be called the higher route. So it's almost like going over here. But then ultimately, punishment was to be had. Like, there was some sort of punishment that came about that it didn't come to the midwives necessarily, but it ultimately came on Pharaoh and the nation of Egypt.
Yeah.
I interpret the Abraham and Isaac story a little bit differently. Like, so they both, like, lied about their wives, basically saying it was their sisters.
Right.
And so we see, like, well, like Max is saying, that, well, they were blessed, so it almost seems like, well, God was for that, you know, like, they profited, like, they got all this land, I mean, they got all this, like, livestock and stuff, so it's like, it looks like God's hand is upon that.
Yeah.
But then what happens their marriages were like kind of messed up. Later on, we were talking about like, well, there was sort of punishment for that choice. Also, the punishment also came on the oppressors of those people. So like, whatever nations Abraham went into, Isaac went into, they were also punished. And I think my ultimate example would be Jesus. So you see that he lived like this perfect life, completely obeying like the sovereignty of God. He also like chose the better way, right? So kind of this combination of the two. But what ultimately happened to him? Punishment fell upon him.
Mm-hmm.
All punishment fell upon him, right? The punishment of the entire earth fell on him and mankind. So ultimately, like, God still says, no, there has to be punishment, and it's going to fall on someone. Ultimately, it fell on Jesus.
Someone has to take that responsibility. And that's why Camp 2 would say, somebody, that we're in a broken world, somebody has to take the responsibility. I'll be the one that takes the responsibility. Yeah. It's good stuff. Good conversations. I encourage you. Let's go ahead and have a seat. I encourage you to keep having these conversations. Keep wrestling. One, as you're sitting, one thing that I see you guys wrestling through well, and this is why I do believe it's a gray area, and that I'm with Hillary. I'm like, I'm pretty confident of what side I know I would stand on what's right, but in the moment, what would I do? Because I see you guys wrestling with this concept of, well, if I'm the midwife or I'm the German who's opening the door and hiding the Jews, I would say if it's my life on the line, my hope would be I would just tell the truth and trust God, because I'm like, God's going to take care of it. And if I die, I die. In a sense, I believe I'll be blessed for that, and God will honor me for telling the truth and for being willing to give up my life for it. But the difficulty and the dilemma comes, it's not just my life. It's the lives of these Hebrew boys. It's the lives of the Jews that I've hidden away. And that's where it becomes tough. I'm not just going to tell the truth and give up my life. If I tell the truth, I might give up the life of those that I'm hiding. So there's that pull I see you guys really working through. But well done. Thanks for jumping up on a Friday and jumping in and talking through it. I know that could have gone on for about an hour easily. I could see some of you just wanted to jump in and we had to cut a little short, but I appreciate you guys just jumping in. Keep wrestling. I'd encourage you, spend some time in these passages. Obviously, this story, Joshua 2, 4 through 5, really that whole story of Rahab. Acts 4, 19, you're going to get to that. You're going to look at Peter and John and what they do in front of the religious authorities. And then Romans 13, as we talk about what it means to obey the government authorities that God has put in place for us. What does that mean to obey God and yet submit ourselves to government authorities? When do we disobey? When do we submit? Romans 13, spend some time in that one. That's a good one. And I really believe where our country is headed and some areas that we're moving as a country, this is going to become more and more real in our lives. Romans 13 is going to be real for us. Not to scare us, but to prepare us in many ways. So with that, I had fun doing that. That was good. Good idea, and glad that we got to do that. So, with that, let's now take a look at chapter 2. So we're finally going to get to Moses. As we talked about, Moses is going to have three developmental periods in his life. Two-thirds of his life is going to be spent on God preparing him, and then the back third is going to be God actually using him as a leader for his people. So, let's jump in. Chapter 2, somebody read just verse 1.
And a man of the house of Levi went and took a wife, as a wife, a daughter of Levi.
Perfect. So now, and this reminds me, someone came up with a good thought yesterday after I wrapped up. I realized when I was talking about the Levites, when we were dividing the land and showing that they didn't have any land, I just completely skipped over it and neglected to say that the priests come from the tribe of Levi. And so when I was talking about the priests scattered all over, I think I neglected to say the reason that the priests are scattered throughout the land is God wants to use them to help connect people to God. And so he doesn't want them just in one chunk of land in the land of Israel. He wants them scattered throughout all the other tribes. So as we see that progress, we're going to see that the priests come from the tribe of Levi. What do you notice in verse 1? It's been 400 years. And the people of Israel have still done a good job of holding on to their identity. Their tribes haven't kind of intermingled, or they haven't become disorganized. They're still holding on to this idea of unique tribes and to the blessing that Jacob had for each one. You're going to see that they, even though it's been 400 years, they've held on to that identity well. Now take a look at 2 through 4, and we're going to get into the life of Moses a little bit.
The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him.
Perfect. So now we see Moses is born, and his mom hides him for 3 months. And just putting yourself in the story, can you imagine being a mom trying to hold a baby quiet and hidden for 3 months? How much pressure she must have been under, just the fear of him crying or being loud or being discovered, knowing that one cry could be ultimately the final cry that basically tips off anybody walking by that she's hiding him, and that could be really the end of his life. And so we see her this fear, and now she knows when he's about 3 months old that it's just he can't be hidden anymore. He's going to be discovered. And so she comes up with a plan. And so she puts him in this basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen or pitch. And it's interesting. I don't want to go real into it, but it's super fascinating as you look back at the ark all the way back in Genesis 6. And if you look forward to Jesus, there's just some really neat ties together when you see this idea of pitch or covering that God had Noah do both inside and outside the ark to keep it afloat, to save those within the ark. And now you see the same pitch used to keep the basket afloat in the river. It preserves Moses. And that word in Hebrew is kippur, which means to cover or atone. And so you're familiar with the term Yom Kippur is the Jewish feast or the Jewish holiday, Day of Atonement, where they celebrate that their sins have been covered, they've been atoned for. And so I'd love to take more time and go deeper into that. It's really fascinating. But if you follow this word along, you begin to see connections between Noah and the ark. You see Moses preserved in this basket. And then you see ultimately that we are preserved, we're atoned for, as we're covered by the blood of Jesus. So there's just amazing, amazing connections there as you begin to see that. We could go a little bit deeper into that, but I encourage you, look into that on your own. It's really fascinating as we see that. And then I believe it's in 1st or 2nd Peter that he alludes to Jesus being the ark that saves us. So take a look at that if you get a chance. Now let's see what happens as Moses' sister, who later on we find out is Miriam, and he also has a brother Aaron, but his sister Miriam stands by at a distance to see what happens. Somebody pick up at 5 and work through verse 9, and let's see what happens.
Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. But Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I shall give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him.
Perfect. It's amazing. So they have this plan. They put the basket in the water. Miriam, his sister, is kind of following it down the river, watching where it ends up. And of all people, I'm curious. I'd love to know, did they know that Pharaoh's daughter was going to come and be bathing there, and they had planned it perfectly, or they were just hoping that someone would have compassion? I would love to know that side of the story. But Pharaoh's daughter, his own daughter, is bathing and sees this baby and feels pity, has compassion for this child. And it's amazing to me as you look at 9, as she sends Miriam and brings Moses, she doesn't know, but Moses' own mother there. And look at this. Isn't it cool? Verse 9, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. That's how good God is in his sovereignty. Is not only does the mother of Moses get to save her child, not only does she get to raise him, but she gets paid by Pharaoh's daughter to raise her own son. How cool is that? Like, to get paid to raise your own kid, that's a pretty good deal. And now, somebody pick up at verse 10. And this is all we're going to have of the first 40 years of Moses' life. We're going to get a little bit more. We're going to jump into Acts 7 for a bit, which gives us just a little bit more. But in Exodus, this is the only snapshot we'll see of the first 40 years of Moses' life. So somebody take verse 10.
The child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, because I drew him out of the water.
So after Moses' mom has raised him for a while, she takes him to the palace, gives him up, and now Pharaoh's daughter is going to raise him the rest of the way. And when we jump into verse 11, it's going to be 40 years later. We just fast forward 40 years. It's fascinating to see that Pharaoh's daughter names him Moses. Moses means to draw out. And it's one of those cool names. You see this all throughout where it has a double meaning. And so Pharaoh's daughter, in a sense, names him Draw Out because she drew him out of the water. And so she calls him Moses. But ultimately, what we know that Moses is going to draw the people out of Egypt. It's just cool to see God at work there and seeing that double meaning for Moses' name. Now let's take verse 11 and 12. And like I said, this is 40 years later. That Moses has been raised in the palace. He's spent time in the near Pharaoh and in the family of Pharaoh. And now Moses has seen enough oppression of his own people. He goes out to visit. So let's take a look at 11 and 12.
One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand.
So we see Moses, he goes out, he visits his people, he wants to see how they're doing. I imagine he's been seeing these beatings, he's been seeing his people mistreated. You see a discontentment in him, you see this burden in him of, this isn't right, I need to do something about it. Now how he goes about it isn't necessarily how, well, after, in view of our three camps, I'd be curious where you all would land and how Moses goes about taking care of this problem of a beating. But notice it says he looks this way and that. There's a couple different thoughts on that. Why do you think he looks this way and that before he takes action? What's that?
So nobody sees him.
There's another thought. It's not a for sure, but there's another thought as well along that. He wants to know the coast is clear. Another thought would be, he looks around and he's like, is anybody going to do anything about this? There's that discontentment. There's that burden. So it could be either or. It could be both. But it's this idea of, yeah, is the coast clear? Is anybody going to see me? Or it's, man, nobody is standing up. Nobody's doing anything. And he just can't take it anymore. Let's take a look at 13 through 14. He comes out the next day and it seems like he's expecting to be well-received because of what he's done, but he gets quite a bit of different reaction. Let's see how they react to him in 13 and 14.
When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? He answered, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, surely the thing is known.
So what happens? Moses goes out the next day. He sees a conflict. He sees his own people fighting each other. And he goes to mediate. And he asks, why do you strike your companion? And what's their response?
You're going to kill me too?
Yeah, it's like, who are you? Like, I just saw you kill someone yesterday. Like, you know, the good old hypocrite thing of like, what are you going to kill me too? Like, how can I trust you? So they basically say, you think you're a prince over us? Might be some jealousy on their part. They know that he's a Hebrew that's been living pretty cush life in the palace and being well-trained and great food every day and basically pampered while his own people are working their tails off and being beaten. And he's so there might be jealousy there as well, but they're just like, who are you? And let's take a look at Acts 7. You guys will work through this with Shay, but we're going to just take a look at a few verses in 7. And we're going to see why Moses came out expecting something different from his own people when he came out the next day. Somebody take 7, verses 17 through 22 when you get there. This is, just to give a little context before you jump in, this is Stephen. He was alluded to earlier. Stephen is now recounting. He's in front of the religious leaders. We know ultimately he gets stoned by the religious leaders because of this speech. And he basically walks through the Old Testament and is trying to show the religious leaders how Jesus is, all the Old Testament characters point forward to Jesus, and he's greater than all these characters. And ultimately, because he kind of picks on the Sunday school heroes of the religious leaders, he gets killed for it. But here he talks about the life of Moses. We get a little bit more insight. Somebody take 17 through 22.
But when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew in multitude in Egypt till another king arose who did not know Joseph. This man dealt treacherously with awe with our people and oppressed our forefathers, making them expose their babies so that they might not live. At this time Moses was born and was well pleasing to God. And he was brought up brought up in his father's house for 3 months. But when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up in her as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, that and was mighty in the words and deeds.
So he's given all the best education and training that one can imagine in Egyptian schooling, and now in 23 and 24. We're going to kind of catch up to where we are in the story. And then 25, we're going to see the highlight or an insight on what was going on in the mind of Moses when he went out there. So somebody take 23 and 24, and then we'll look at 25 after that.
But when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian.
So this brings us to where we are in the story, and now we see an insight of what was going on in Moses' mind when he goes back out the next day. Verse 25 says, he supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand, but they did not understand. Exodus doesn't tell us much about what's going on in the life of Moses. But Acts gives us a little bit of insight that at some point during Moses' first 40 years, we can assume that God was beginning to work in his heart and show Moses that he was going to use Moses to lead the people of Israel out, that salvation was going to come from God through Moses. And so here's Moses at age 40 saying, I'm ready to go. Let's get these people out of here. I've had enough. And so he goes out. And really, before God gives him the go-ahead, he jumps the gun a little bit and says, it's time. And so he's ready to start basically a rebellion and lead him out. And so he's thinking that the Hebrews must know this. The Hebrews know that I'm the guy that God's going to use, and he expects that sort of reception from them. Instead, what we saw is they just react and say, who are you? They don't even know or care who he is, and Moses isn't yet ready to lead. God still wants to do something and a work in Moses. God, we see Moses is in his first third of preparation. And God, we're going to see here in just the next few verses, God is now going to take Moses out of Egypt. He's going to take him into the wilderness, into obscurity, to shape him into the leader that he wants him to be before he just has Moses lead right away. So Moses was ready to lead. His people weren't ready. And God wasn't done with shaping Moses into the leader that he is. This is a great lesson, by the way, if you're in ministry, I mean in life in general. But I've been finding God's never in a hurry. That's something that I think as a young guy is at times frustrating, but also encouraging, knowing that God's timing is God's timing. And sometimes it's patient, sometimes it's quick. For me, just a little bit of my story out in Madeira, it's interesting. So I'm part of the elder board of the church, and I'm honored to serve the church. So it's me and three other guys, and these guys are in their 50s and 60s, and I'm a 25-year-old punk, basically, that's like, hey, I want to see the church move. I want us to, let's go. I want to grow. I want to see our life groups take off. We need to make decisions. Let's move. And I'm a little bit, I'm impatient, and I want to see things grow. I want to see it take off. And I'll be honest, my first year or two out there being a part of this elder team, my attitude was very impatient and very young and very immature and still is in many ways. But God has been showing me that God's timing is so much different than mine. I would love to see immediate growth. I would love to see immediate change. And each time, the elders kind of slow me down. I'm so thankful we have elders that take everything back to Scripture. And I'll be like, hey, you know what? I believe this is what God would have us do. Let's just do it. And they're ones to sit on it for 2, sometimes 3, sometimes 4, sometimes 5 months before we'll move on something. And I'm dying. I'm like, this should be 5 months ago. We could have had this person in this position, and we could have, oh man, our youth ministry should be here. And each time I look back, when the decision was made, it was exactly when it needed to be made. And when I look back, if it would have been in my timing, it would have been too soon, it would have been rushed, it would have been a bad decision. And I've come back to those elders time and time again and just confessed, I'm young, I'm immature, I'm impatient, thank you. I would have made so many mistakes already in my first 2 years as a pastor if it weren't for you guys. And so I want to encourage you guys, when you're on a team, and even in your life, as you want to move quicker, you want to be like Moses. You want to be, all right, it's been 4 years. I'm ready to lead. I know God is going to use me to lead these people out. I'm ready to go. Let's go. God is, in a sense, sometimes going to say, no, it's going to be another 40 years. Now, I don't know that God's going to wait till we're all 80, until he's going to use us. It's a little bit different timing in God's word. But there may be times where God is going to take you out into the desert. God is going to put you in a season where you're not where you want to be yet. You're not where you think God wants you yet. And God is going to take you to a place where he's going to shape you. He's going to work in you. He's going to make you be patient. And then when he puts you in the position, you're going to be the person that God wants you to be in that position to lead well. And so that's something I'm learning slowly but surely, and still very impatient in many ways. Let's take a look back. Let's jump back into Exodus. And let's see what happens now as God is preparing to take Moses and shape him as a leader out in the desert. And so after Moses realized, oh man, these rumors have gone around. I just killed someone. I'm no longer safe here. Somebody read verse 15 of chapter 2. So we see that Pharaoh realizes that Moses is not a team player for Team Egypt. He sees that Moses' heart lies with the Hebrew people. And so Pharaoh no longer has any room for Moses, and he basically puts out a hitman for him and wants to take Moses out because he sees Moses, he's well-trained, he's well-educated, he knows the Egyptians well, he knows the Hebrews well. So Pharaoh wants to take him out. So Moses takes off, heads out to the desert in Midian. It's interesting, the Hebrew word for desert is midbar, which means to speak. And so what we're going to see is God takes Moses out to the desert. God is going to speak to Moses. He's going to shape him. He's going to change him as a leader and prepare him for the back third of his life. Just real quick as we look at the map. So what we're going to see is Moses is somewhere around here at this point. In Egypt, near the Nile River, his people, where he killed the Egyptian slave master, going to be in Goshen, has that all this conversation where we've been. He's right here. When Pharaoh finds out that Moses is no longer on his team, Moses is going to take off, and he's going to end up a couple hundred miles away, somewhere near Midian, or in Midian, somewhere near here. So this is where we're going to see Moses the next 40 years of his life. Is in this dry, hot wasteland, shepherding sheep where he's probably bored as can be, but it gives God time to speak to Moses and to change and to shape Moses. So that's where you're going to see him these next 40 years. So with that, I want you to notice something in Moses' character as he's in the desert. Right away, we see again in verse 16 and 17. Tell me what you notice about Moses as we read those two verses.
Now the priests of Midian had seven daughters, and they came up and drew, water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flocks.
Perfect. So what do you see in the heart of Moses again? As he's in the desert, he's on his own.
He seems to step up for, you know, the voiceless or the helpless.
Yeah, he steps up for the voiceless, the helpless, the oppressed. What would we call that in common day terms that we use a lot? We throw it around a lot.
Mercy.
Social justice. Yeah. I know a few of you go to Fresno Pacific or have been to Fresno, you've probably heard that term too much in many ways. There it is. But it's this idea of, I'm going to step up for those who don't have a voice, for those who are being oppressed, for those who are helpless. We see this in the heart of Moses time and time again. And we notice that this bothers him. This is a holy discontent, if you will, of Moses. He will not stand by and allow the oppressed to continue to be oppressed. Now let's take a look at verse 18 through 22 and see what happens.
When they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "Why have you come back so soon today?" So they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom. He said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land."
Now, I forgot to mention in verse 16 is the first time we see the priest of Midian, who here is called Reuel, or however you would say his name. But we'll also see him pop up later as Jethro. Seems to be used synonymously. And we're going to see him come later on in the story where Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, comes and gives Moses some really good advice. And so we're going to see if you see Reuel or Jethro pop up. He's the priest of Midian, but also now Moses' father-in-law. So Reuel says, you know, to his daughters, "You guys got home earlier than usual. What's going on?" And they tell him about Moses. He's like, "Well, go get him. Don't leave him out there. He's probably dying. Bring him in." And so he welcomes him into his home. Moses is content to stay there. He ends up marrying one of his daughters, Zipporah, and gives birth to his son. So once again, now we're going to see that Moses is going to spend 40 years out in this desert wasteland. 40 years where God has him shepherding sheep, where he's learning patience. We're going to see later on that in many ways, the people of Israel and even ourselves are referred to as sheep, which are dumb, which are, we wander, we're hard to keep going in the right direction. And so what we see God doing is preparing in the heart of Moses what it is to keep and to lead and direct sheep for 40 years, because in a sense he's going to get to do the same exact thing, but they're in people form instead of sheep form when they're wandering around in the desert. So we see God working in him already in these 40 years. And so we'll wrap up this morning with finishing out chapter 2 here. Let's go 23 through 25.
During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew.
Perfect. So here we see for the first time in 400 years, God is going to, in a sense, show his presence to the people of Israel. They begin to cry out for help. Verse 24 says God remembered. That doesn't mean for 400 years God just simply forgot his relationship and his covenant that he had made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This word, God, or this phrase, God remembered, just means he was stirred to action. So God has been observing. We see right here, God hears, he feels, he sees. God is a God who hears what's going on in our lives. He sees what's going on in our lives. He feels it. And he's been feeling that for 400 years. But now he says, I'm working on Moses. The people are finally crying out. I'm ready to move. I'm ready to act. And so he's stirred to action. And then in chapter 3, he's going to approach Moses, and we're going to see God's, basically his action plan, his strategy for redeeming these people. Yeah.
Just a question about the priest of Midian. Do you know, what's the Hebrew for, what does Ruel mean? Or what does Ruel mean?
That's a good question. Let's see if we can pull it up here.
Friend of God.
Friend of God?
Pretty sure.
Got it? Okay, let me see. Where are you? What, verse 16? Let me try this. I can't see. Let's see. Where's his name? 18. There it is. Let's see if we can cheat here. Yeah, I'd have to look into it a little more. I'll look into it a bit. I'm not sure. But we'll go with Nick's for now. How's that?
Mine is the Strong's number.
Okay.
So it's it.
Okay. Perfect. All right, we'll go with that. I'd be curious, too. I'd love to look into why does he go from Reuel to Jethro, or if those mean the same thing, maybe in Midianite. I'm not sure exactly. So, but you'll see him pop up more later. So just an encouragement for you guys as we wrap up. I've enjoyed getting the opportunity to just be with you guys the past few days and walk through the end of Genesis, beginning of Exodus. I want to encourage you as you look at the life of Moses, and you're going to continue to see this, as way of personal application as we go this week, is just ask the question, what is God teaching you in this season? God uses every season to teach each one of us and to work in us and shape us, and we may not be where we want to be yet or where we think God will have us be, but we need to ask the question. Sometimes we're in the desert, what's God shaping in me? I know for me personally, and I know for many of us, we always want to be the next stage of life. When I was, you know, in high school, college, everybody's always asking you, when are you going to get a girlfriend? When are you going to start dating? And then once you're dating someone, when are you going to propose? When are you guys going to be engaged? Once you're engaged, when's the date? When are you going to get married? When you're married, when are you going to have kids? And it just kind of, everybody expects you to be the next stage. And sometimes you feel that internal pressure too of like, I'm not where I should be. I'm not where I want to be. And I want to say there's a reason God has you in the stage of life you are. If you're listening to his voice, if you're being obedient, he's got you in the place that you want. It may feel like the desert, but God wants you to be teachable and obedient and to be shaped in that season so that he can move you into the next step he has for you. And it's awesome to see Moses, in a sense, be content in the desert of Midian and say, all right, here we go. I'm going to lead some sheep, and I'm going to listen for the voice of God. I'm going to allow him to speak to me and shape me and make me the leader. I know one day I'm going to lead these people out. So with that, I appreciate this time with you guys. And Mike will pick up from Exodus 3 with you guys. So, all right, have a great day.